Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and we're here every week to talk about mental health issues from a holistic perspective, which means finding balance between mind, body, and spirit. Now, we all know that the truth will set you free. The question we ask here is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? So before I tell you about tonight's topic and introduce my guest, I have a few business things to take care of. First of all, it is Mother's Day on Sunday, and I want to wish my mom and my stepmom a very happy Mother's Day, and to all the mothers out there, very, very happy Mother's Day. And also, May is a very busy month for me with birthdays, and I want to wish my brother Mark a happy birthday. My dad's birthday is also on Sunday, Mother's Day. My Aunt Natalie is her birthday just passed, and two of my closest friends, Jim Terusa and Jeremy Atkins, happy birthday to all of you, and anyone else having a birthday this month. Now, also, the other final piece of business is, we're giving away tickets on the show tonight to our first two callers, and it's for the play Tuesdays with Maury. Mitch Albom's book has been made into a play, and it is going to be presented at the Mesa Arts Center from June 2nd through June 11th, and we'll be giving away two sets of tickets to any performance between June 2nd and June 11th at the Mesa Arts Center. And this is being presented by the Arizona Theater Company. And so if you want these tickets, call in, give us a comment about tonight's show, any questions you might ask. And today's show, actually, is going to be a very practical one. There's a book that's been published recently called What They Don't Teach You in College, A Graduate's Guide to Life on Your Own. Its intro is an expert advice about jobs, money, cars, taxes, insurance, apartments, and everything else that lets you know the future has arrived. The author of this book is an attorney, actually, so you know the information in this book is going to be very accurate and very focused. His name is James Crayman. He's an attorney in Baltimore, Maryland. And James, I want to thank you for being on the show tonight.
Thank you, Stuart. Good evening.
Good evening to you. And I know it's much more of an evening on the East Coast than it is for us here right now. So I really appreciate you taking some time on your Friday night to talk with us.
I'm happy to do it.
I'm glad. And now, to kind of get into this book, I actually was able to get out and buy a copy a few hours ago at Target, and I know it's at Borders and a few other bookstores.
Barnes & Noble.
There is Barnes & Noble. Thank you. I knew it was in there. Now, a lot of us enter adulthood not really prepared for it. And when we're talking about adulthood, we're talking about handling not just day-to-day business, but handling the practical things that we're not always taught by our parents. How to deal with finances in particular is a major one, and yet I know that you cover a lot of things in this book. Why did you write this book?
The book actually wrote itself, by which I mean this. It evolved over years of giving advice to a lot of people, many of them recent graduates of colleges or high schools, who were going out and starting their independent lives. But it could have been others, divorcees, or just young adults getting started. And what I realized, you don't have to be too clever to realize it, is you get beaten up out there. You get handed a lot of documents that are long and complicated. You have to deal with a lot of parties that are, you know, a lot bigger than you are, corporations, and stronger than you are, and can be rather indifferent. And it's a tough world for people. A college education doesn't help much at all, which is, I guess, what the title of the book suggests. I was writing the book while one of my kids was finishing college, and another was thinking about going, so I, you know, thought about these issues a lot, talking to them, talking to their friends, and I realized that there were ways I could make it an awful lot easier and safer, and also let people feel that they had some power in the whole thing, which they do. And to do that, I would have to explain the procedures, but in a very kind of practical way. I use the checklist approach. I'm a big checklist person for everything I do, my legal work and everything that I do with my family and so forth. I find that's useful. And over the years, the checklists evolved. You know, I would help a young person the first time with her lease, and then the second time I would think, oh, this would be a good thing to add. And after a while, I had a very easy-to-use product. You don't need to be clever to read the checklists in this book and the little paragraphs explaining each one. And explanations, I think, are important, too, because things are befuddling, you know. You go in to buy a car or get an insurance policy, and they hand you a document that needs a set of wheels. And, you know, it puts you off. It has words in it you're not familiar with. Most people don't want to go to law school in order to be able to, you know, deal with banks and insurance companies and credit companies and so forth. And mm-hmm. It isn't necessary. So the purpose of the book is to make it livable for people. I think that's the best word.
I have a phrase I like to use, and that is, no one knows until they know.
Yep.
And a lot of the stuff in your book are things that I think a lot of people would be embarrassed to start asking about. They are things that, if you think about it, we should have learned growing up from our parents, how to open a checking account, how to reconcile or balance the checking account, how to make sure you actually open that bank statement at the end of the month when it arrives so that you know what your balance is and how your money's being spent, if there are any errors that you need to look for. And yet many of us may not have grown up in households where finances and legal things like this were either taught to us or we didn't have a real good example because maybe our parents really didn't have a strong handle on this. So knowledge equals power, and that's what this book is about. It's about empowering ourselves by gaining the knowledge, and in a lot of cases, it's very simple knowledge. So the point is, from what I see with this book, is you answer the questions that a lot of people either don't know to ask or are too embarrassed to ask.
Well, I think that's true, but I want to say to everybody who's listening and thinking about this, forget the embarrassment. I'll tell you what the embarrassment is, and it's not the people who are listening to your program. The embarrassment is that largely as a result of my profession, I'm sorry for that, everything is very, very what shall I say, obtuse, difficult, you know, thorny, in ways that need not be the case. I can give you a very good example of where that was concluded in a very public way. In one of the states of the United States, maybe more now, but in one for sure, that being New York, the courts got tired of having people come in where one side understood the document carefully, of course, the corporate side with all the lawyers and so forth, and the other side didn't even know what the words meant. So they passed the law called plain English. That's a law they don't talk about too much in law school. Plain English means if you do certain documents, you put them in a language that ordinary people can understand. You know, forget all this subordination, estoppel, atonement, and all these terms that no one ever heard of. You write a lease and tell the person what you're leasing to them, for how much, for how long, what they're required to do, what you, the landlord, are going to do, and then close it up. Don't give us this 40-page, half-Latin thing. Unfortunately, you know, that's an exceptional occurrence. But what you can do with this book, I am certain you can do it with this book, because dozens and probably hundreds of people have tried these things out along the way, is open to the checklist for leases, follow what it says, and you will cover the important points. You're right, absolutely, Stuart, you couldn't be more right, that, you know, you don't know it until you know it. But one of the sad things is, you often find it out after you've walked in the hole, you know?
Right.
You know the hole is there, but the problem is you've broken your leg. You know, and some of the examples are so simple. In fact, just about all of them are so simple. I'll give you one just to give you the idea.
Let me stop you for just a minute, because I want to remind people that we have a very intelligent lawyer on the show today. That's James Crayman, and the book is called What They Don't Teach You in College, A Graduate's Guide to Life on Your Own. And if you're one of the first two callers at 480-949-1310, that's 480-949-1310, you'll be getting a pair of tickets to Tuesdays with Mari, in addition to being able to put your 2 cents into this conversation tonight. So go ahead with what you were going to say.
Example I was going to give just was coming to mind because we're talking about leases. This is a common occurrence. A young woman or man goes out, leases their first apartment, gets a job, does the things that they should do, plan their finances, do the banking right, all of which is set forth again in here very simply. But the lease is a one-year lease only, and they fix the place up, they buy all the furniture, everything's very nice. What do they get in the 11th month? They get a notice from the landlord that the rent is going up 35%. How do you like that? Now, what can you do about that? You can't do anything about it at that point. But if you read the checklist before you did the lease, you wouldn't have to do anything about it, because one of the items in the checklist is that you should get an option to renew at a price that is established. If a lease goes up a couple percent a year, okay, fair enough, inflation, so forth, cost of living. If a lease goes up 35% a year, you know what's happening. The landlord is putting a gun to your head, because he knows that it'll cost you money to move, that all the things you bought won't fit perfectly, that you're going to be inconvenienced at work and spend money, and so on and so forth.
Plus, if you did improvements to the apartment, he knows he can get better rent on the next person coming in if you decide to leave.
Absolutely. They couldn't be more right. One of the cruel facts of life, and anybody who doesn't realize this will realize it sooner or later, the big parties at the other end of the deal are in it for money. I'm not saying they'll shoot you in the middle of the street. Maybe a few will. I hope not many. but they're not giving you any breaks. You're not getting any breaks. They didn't hire a lawyer for a couple of $100 or more an hour, and I assure you that's what you'd pay in any city where your listeners are. And tell the lawyer, look, I want you to draw me documents that'll treat the customer very nicely. Draw me an insurance policy that'll be very nice to the homeowner and the automobile driver and so forth. I guarantee you the insurance company didn't pull them in there for that. Same thing with health care, same thing with every warranty and financial document you'll ever see. They were drawn for the party on the other side of the table from you.
Let's talk about health care for a minute, because I think it's probably one of the most important things. When we're a minor, when we're under 18, most of what we do with our health care is with our parents in the room with us for the most part, or at least the doctor has the legal right to discuss things with our parents. So they're in the loop. Once we're past 18, maybe we're even a freshman or a sophomore in college, but specifically when you've graduated college, you're now on your own, and unless you choose to consult with your parents on these things. You're the one making the decisions about insurance, about treatments, and things like that. What does your book do to help somebody start realizing that it's their body, it's their life, it's their health, and they have a right to empower themselves to ask the doctor questions and take control of their own treatments?
You're absolutely right, and it's a tremendous issue because everybody is confronting a healthcare situation in the United States that is something less than perfect. In fact, a lot less than perfect. What my book does is a couple of things that are key. First of all, it explains each different way, and there are five or six of them, but, you know, if you read the book, you'll see what they are, that you can be covered, what different types of coverage there are. It spends a good deal of time on HMOs because HMOs have become, for most Americans, the insurance that they will acquire. It tells you where to go for the different forms of insurance, where you look first, how you look through your employer, how you look through organizations to which you belong, and then how you look on the open market if you don't have any of those kinds of inroads to health insurance. It tells you exactly what you look for, what criteria you should use in making your selection, and it tells you how to afford the right kind of coverage. It sounds like a silly thing, but there is no way without some assistance anyone can figure out what their health care is going to cost. If you think it's going to cost you just the amount that you pay for your HMO's fee or the amount that you contribute after your employer pays some, wrong. You have copays, you have deductibles, you have uncovered things, you have drugs, you have numerous variations on the theme. I've put in the book an exact formula. You can determine exactly what it'll cost you if you go down X road or Y road, and you'll be fully informed and able to make a decision. This is something, you know, there are things I say, you know, go through it, get it over with, and cut to the chase. This is something I would spend a little time on. I don't mean weeks, but I mean some hours to think about, talk to people, find out some things about the way your employer would handle it, if you have an employer that does handle it, and so forth. Because if you make a good decision, you're going to save an awful lot of money, and you're going to get much, much better health care. In addition to that, I'm answering your question too long, but this is so important.
No, go ahead. You're fine.
I tell people how to use the coverage once they get it. You know, a week doesn't go by, so help me, a week doesn't go by, that I don't get a call from some client or a family member of some client. I can't get my insurer to, and then you fill in the blanks. It can be a million different things. This book tells you how to accomplish that. It gives you the letters that you need. It tells you the places that you call. It tells you exactly where the provision is that you want to follow to make sure that they don't do a gotcha on you, which they would love to do. This is priority matter.
A lot of people, when they're graduating college, are likely to get a job with a company that does provide health insurance. But there are a lot of people who may not finish college or may not even just chose to go to college. As you know, a lot of people are making that choice today out of high school. And this book is just as important to them, if not more so, because they may need, I mean, their company still may provide health insurance, but they may need to make these decisions in a more educated and supportive way than even a college graduate might. Wouldn't you agree with that?
I would absolutely agree with that, and it's interesting, Stuart, that if you look at 100 random people, first of all, unfortunately, 45 or so of them are going to be uninsured altogether, but of those who are insured, you will not find that the best coverage goes to those with the most education. You will find that the best coverage goes to certain categories of people. For example, state workers in almost every state get very nice coverage. People who are associated with certain types of institutions get very nice coverage. People who have what one might call blue-collar jobs, I've never been sure what that meant, but whatever it means at a major industry, a heavy industry, a steel company, something like that, they get pretty good coverage. The college graduate may get good coverage, but they also may go to work for a business that provides none.
So what do you say to them in the book?
What I'm saying to them and to everybody is, go through the order of possibilities I give you, and then you will make a decision based upon them. One of the things that you will find out along the way is what coverage you are entitled to as a matter of law. Let me explain, for example, what I mean. There are states, I happen to live in one of them, but there are a number of states where there is what's called an insurer of last resort. In Maryland, that insurer is our Blue Cross Blue Shield, which is called CareFirst Blue Cross Blue Shield. What that means is that insurer has to offer a very wide range of products to a very large group of people, and they cannot turn you down, for example, because of a pre-existing illness. Many states have that for different types of insurers. I tell you in the book how to find it out. You know, if you're going out trying to get insurance, and you're any older than 3 nanoseconds, you've probably had an illness. And if you're in your 30s, 40s, and 50s, if you haven't had any illness at all, you're unusual. Pre-existing condition exclusions are very, very dangerous, because if that happens to be the illness that comes back to plague you with very serious consequences or lifelong consequences, you're paying the bills. And you certainly do not want that.
Mm-hmm.
So,
What do you say to parents? I mean, for the most part, even through college, most parents' health insurance policies stay in effect as long as the kid is still in college, as I understand it. At least that's the case many times. Once they graduate, a lot of people in their 20s, early 20s, usually health insurance is not the first thing on their mind. It's about earning a paycheck and buying the things that they want to buy. So the parents need to be setting the example, and the parents need to be discussing with them, this health insurance policy is no longer going to be in effect 6 months after you're out of college. So you need to get this, and this is why.
Well,
and this
I
is
can
how
actually,
it's helped you in the past.
I can answer the question in a very real, as distinguished from a hypothetical way. My daughter finishes college next Saturday, the 20-whatever-it-is.
Mm-hmm.
She is covered on my family's policy until the last day of this month. In other words, 3 days after she finishes college. No, 10 days, I'm sorry. 10 days after she finishes college, she no longer has any coverage at all. Now, what I have to go through is exactly what everybody has to go through. One of the things that gives you a little breathing space if you need it is what's called COBRA. COBRA is the right of participants in group plans to continue for different periods of time. Usually it's 18 months, but there are times when it's more than that, if they pay the monthly amount that it costs the plan to include them. It's not the forever solution, but you can do that. What I have done, though, and what I certainly recommend everyone do is don't wait until the week before your child is finishing college. Start early and go through what this book explains, helping the child to make a selection so that you will be able to have a policy when that group family coverage expires. And what you'll find, that there's very little good news in this area, but what you'll find is in nearly every state, age is a very important factor. So So you're going to do a lot better for a young person, a child graduating college, probably in the early 20s, mostly that occurs. You're going to do a lot better than, you know, you will do later on.
Mm-hmm. One thing key that you said was helping your kid get this policy and make the decisions. All too often, the parents say, okay, this is the policy I decided for you. This is what it's going to cost. This is what you're going to have to pay for it, or I'll pay half. In other words, they're not really putting the responsibility and the education onto their kid, which is why I believe a lot of parents do their kids a disservice by just doing it because they don't have the patience to sit with them and teach them how to do it.
You know, one of the things that you're touching on, and you know a lot more about it, I'm sure, than I do, is people have a very hard time contemplating their own demise and ultimate death. You know, lawyers all the time, when they finish doing wills for clients, sit down, go over the finished document, and then they ask the client what they want to do with it, and they say, oh, I'll take it. You say, oh, that's interesting, and who is going to admit it to probate? And they say, well, I'll take care of that, right? You will be the first dead person ever to bring your own will into the orphan court. You know, it's never happened yet, but you're gonna do it. Oh, my gosh, I won't be here. Let me see. Okay, well, this is that kind of situation. You may be able to make a very good selection for your child now, not just medical insurance, but 100 other things. But the time is going to come when you're not there to make that selection.
Or those kids need to help start making decisions for you.
That's right.
Because you're getting older. You want to teach them enough so that you have the peace of mind of knowing when they're in the position of caring for you as you get older and maybe infirm, that you've trained them well enough to make healthy decisions for you.
Absolutely. You absolutely do. And you make them strong that way. You know, everything that a person can learn to do, as all of us know, gives them confidence. You know, these things are not daunting once you really get into them. I know that from sitting hundreds of times with young people. You know, the first time a young person goes into a bank, they're often horrified. And the way banks treat you, it's not surprising. But once they get the drill down, they're fine.
You mentioned in your book, and you just mentioned a little while ago, the issue of wills. Now, most people who are 22 years old are going to say, why do I need a will? You know, it's not that they may not understand that they could get hit by a car and die tomorrow, but their question would be, why do I need a will at this age? What do I have?
Well, the answer may be nothing, and it also may be you don't, but it may be otherwise too. One of the things that happens because of the way the marketplace behaves, which is totally dishonest in almost every respect, is people don't really understand what is involved in different decisions, especially ones like dying, which have a lot of emotional factors. I'll give you an example. You turn on your TV and watch it for tonight or any other night, and you will see ads for life insurance for children. The suggestion in those ads is that if you really love your child, you'd buy life insurance for that little 6-month-old, 12-month-old baby because, you know, they're so valuable, you love them, and so forth. And, of course, the answer is you do love them, but the rest of the answer is, what in God's name does a child need life insurance for? They don't support anybody. They don't have any debts. There's nothing to pay off when they die other than the very sad cost of a funeral, but, you know, that's, I think, a very small reason to buy life insurance. Fact of the matter is they don't need it, and they also don't need wills and many other things. But when the point in time comes that you need it, then you have to understand what it does. A lot of people don't understand what a will does. For example, if you own a house jointly with your spouse, your husband or your wife, and you die, A will doesn't have any effect on the house at all. Why? Because the house passes to the survivor as his or her sole property by what is known as operation of law. That's what it means to own it jointly. So you can say in your will 100 things about what you want to happen to the house, but insofar as your wife or husband is concerned, has no effect if you own your house jointly with that person. What you need to do is understand some basic things about that. They are set forth in the book in a sort of truncated way, a shortened way, because that's something farther down the line. It's something somebody's going to get to for sure, but in order to just begin living in the world, it isn't item number one. You know, if you have $10 million, then everything I said, scratch it off. It is item one. The other thing is save yourself $12.95 and don't buy the book if you have $10 million. You know, you go get somebody to do everything. But this book's not written for people in that circumstance.
Well, one of the other issues that you brought up about houses and wills and things like that really brings home what a lot of people are talking about in terms of unmarried partners, gay or lesbian or heterosexual partners that choose not to get married legally but still have a commitment to one another and are accumulating wealth or real estate or are there for each other. A lot of these legal things have to be in place in order to protect the partner, wouldn't you say?
Interesting that you'd bring that up, because I happen to have a situation right now, two people who lived together for 25 years and things are going south in the relationship, and they live in one of the states around here which does not recognize a common law marriage no matter what. They held themselves out as husband and wife for this whole quarter of a century. When people learned that they weren't husband and wife, in fact, they were, terribly surprised. But now they're in the situation where they felt as though they were husband and wife, and the person on the downside financially felt it as well as the other, but in fact they weren't. Think about these things. That's the only answer that anyone can give you. If you are in a non-officially marital relationship, or in a relationship which is right now in question, I make no judgment in this regard, but gay and lesbian marriages are a matter in flux in 49 out of 50 states. Some advice. Get some advice, and there are things that you can do about it. There are ways you can adjust nearly all of the things that you want to adjust without a formal marriage. There may be a very small number of exceptions, but almost every state today has a vehicle whereby you can arrange all kinds of things in relationships other than, traditionally acknowledged marriages. And you need some help with that. That's something that's serious, because if you have a partner and you're in there for the long pull, you want these things to be right. If children are involved, you owe it to them to get them right.
Now, I want to remind my listeners, if you have a question for myself or for James Crayman about what we're talking about, feel free to call in, and the first two callers, like I said before, will get two free tickets to the Arizona Theater Company's production of Tuesdays with Maury at the Mesa Arts Center from June 2nd to June 11th. And the number is 480-949-1310. Now, another comment that I want to make. When I was growing up, I think weekly or every other week, I saw my mom and dad sit down at the dining room table with the checkbook, the pile of bills, and everything else, and they would do this together. My mom would write out the checks, and my dad would get them in the envelope. So basically, she knew what was going on in terms of finances. They knew how to support each other. And in a lot of cases, we mentioned a few different scenarios of other people who might really make good use of this book. But the one thing we didn't mention were the widows or widowers. You know, and often, if it's a relationship where the man has really ruled the roost, so to speak, and handled all the finances, and he's the first to die, or there's a divorce, and all of a sudden this woman, and sometimes the man, is found like, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to open a checking account. I don't know how to create a budget. I don't know how to do these legal things myself. So this is a great book that goes beyond just high school and college graduates and is something that really can make a difference for those people later in life who have never really had to handle these things themselves. Have you had feedback from any of them along the way?
Oh, absolutely. Very definitely, Stuart. Many of them. In fact, one of the things that happens, and it's usually to women because women tend to outlive their husbands, although obviously there are significant exceptions, is that they reach a point in time where if they had a very traditional kind of relationship where, you know, the man handled the finances, usually far worse than the woman would have, but handled them anyway. And I mean that seriously. You know, it's like the thing about directions. Women ask for directions and men know the way. 3 hours later, they still know the way, but they haven't gotten there yet. But this is an embarrassing time for the person on the short end of the knowledge because they've lost their ally. You know, they've lost the person who took care of it all that time. I can tell you for sure, having been through it myself in my own family, my father predeceased my mother when I was quite young, you can learn, you being the one on the surviving end who hasn't had the experience. You can sit down, you can understand what's set forth in this book, you can do it. There's no reason for it not to be learned. You can learn it at 30, at 40, at 60. It doesn't make any difference. And what will happen is that you, the survivor I'm speaking to now, will feel a lot better. There's nothing that feels as bad as being completely in the dark. It's not a question of trust or distrust. I hope you won't deal with people who are not trustworthy. It's just a feeling of foolishness, you know? Why can't I understand who I owe money to? Why can't I use a credit card? Why can't I bank? What are the responsibilities to my house? Well, you know, how do I keep a car? What insurance do I need? All that is very doable. And my
without relying on your children to take over then.
Right? Yeah, children. They very often, you know, it comes at that time too. But you know, there are a lot of people. I know 50 widows, I mean, I don't know what number it is, who did not handle finances, and I know a few widowers in the same situation, far less, but I know them, that, you know, came into this kind of situation sometimes in their 70s, usually earlier, but sometimes, and they pick it up and they can do it. You know, the other thing is, don't be afraid to ask questions. You know, it's stupid people don't ask questions. A lot of people have the feeling that, oh, if I ask questions, I show how little I know. Oh, no, no. Yeah, that's backwards. The person who doesn't ask the question because he or she needs the information is the foolish person. And I'll say one more thing in that regard. That there are a lot of people today at what I would call the big guy end of the spectrum who make you feel foolish about asking questions. You know, the banker who doesn't have time for your silly questions, or the insurance company that doesn't have time. Shame on all of them. Don't feel foolish. And if you don't get the answers that you need, put the questions in writing the way this book tells you to, and insist upon the answers before you go forward.
Or find another banker.
Buy something.
Or find
and
another banker.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
You don't go forward. You say, mm-hmm. look, I want to bank in this bank, but I need the following information. And if you don't have time for me, I understand I'm leaving. And if you want me as a customer, you find time to answer my questions.
Exactly.
That's all.
And that applies for your physicians also, by the way.
Absolutely.
You know, if your doctor doesn't have time to sit down with you and answer questions and support you when you're dealing with some very serious things, or even if they're simple things, find another doctor.
For sure. For sure.
Now, let's talk about budgets. What do you say in the book about helping particularly young people who don't really have a sense of money sometimes? How do they create a budget? Why is it important to have a budget and to live by it?
Well, there are a number of things you need to know. First of all, you need to know how to handle. I'm going to take a drink of water.
Okay, go for it. So while he's doing that, I want to remind you, if you want to call in, the number is 480-949-1310. You're listening to Stuart Altshuler and James Kremen. We're talking about what they don't teach you in college, and this is KXAM 1310 in Phoenix.
Hey.
Feeling better?
I'm better, and thank you.
Okay, let's go to budgets now.
To know
a lot of us get choked up when we're talking about budgets. So.
Yeah, it's a very unhappy subject. You need to know how to handle a checking account. You need to know about credit cards. And you need to know about the budget generally, that is, expenses and receipts. And you need to go over it periodically because things change, you know. Your taxes will change or an expense will become different than it was. Insurance will go up or, you know, there'll be an unexpected expense. Or you're not sure if you have enough money for a vacation or even for a very large endeavor like buying a car and you want to know, can I afford this? You must have a budget to do that. One of the things I can't emphasize enough, and nobody who does this kind of work could emphasize enough, is allow slack. You know, don't go up to the last dollar. Give yourself a margin, whether it's 10% or 20% or some percentage of your income, because nobody in this world, as you know, Stuart, nobody in this world has ever not had unexpected expenses.
Right.
You're always going to. And one other piece of advice, which only half the people listening or less will take, but I got to give it because anybody who doesn't would be negligent. One credit card. That's one, O-N-E, credit card. Not multiple credit cards. If you go down to bankruptcy court, or if you go to any of my colleagues who do distressed financing work, which there are people that specialize in, and you say to them, what is the most common denominator of financial distress that you see in 20 years in your 1,500 cases, what's the most common? The answer will be multiple credit cards.
Mm-hmm.
Every one of them will give you the same answer. You know, they're so easy to get. They come in the mail. They're not going to charge you anything for the first 3 months. You know, if you think that those things work, then almost nothing else, you know, can be useful. If I may make a medical analogy, a doctor will tell a diabetic, if you're not going to stop eating sugar, then forget all the rest of the things I'm telling you. You know, it's irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
You must stop eating sugar. Now we'll talk about vitamins and minerals and proteins and all kinds of other things. But if you're not going to stop eating sugar, leave. Well, what I'm saying is, if you're going to mishandle credit cards, forget everything else, because you're going to destroy yourself.
Well, a lot of people don't know they're going to mishandle them until they get them. And one of the problems that we see in colleges all over the country today is that they're basically pushed on a lot of these students. They're so easy to get. They're sent to them sometimes without them even applying for them. And to them, it's like, oh, I can go to that concert. Oh, I can get the extra speakers for my car. You know, with the cost of gas now, well, I need to go there, so I'll put it on a credit card. And nobody's taught any of us, and I know this has been a problem in my life too, a tremendous problem, because nobody's ever taught us, in fact, very few people have ever taught us, how to handle credit, when it's appropriate to use, when it's not, how to keep it from getting, you know, carried away. And it is a major issue, not just for adults, but for a lot of students.
It is, absolutely, and the solicitation, or forcing it down your throat more accurately, that the credit companies do is nothing short of disgusting. You know, you send your kid out in the world and try and put them, you know, on their first credit card. You always put a limit, and parents guarantee it, and, you know, every month you reconcile it, and discuss it, and you do everything you can, and all of a sudden, a deluge of credit card things start coming in. They come into the student's own address, they come into your house, and it's outrageous. It should not be permitted. Shame on all of us for tolerating it, and all I can say is one credit card. The reason I say one is, you then can establish a limit. And if you can't get that high a limit from one company, there's probably a good reason. Probably because you're not yet ready for that much credit. And secondly, because you must reconcile it. I know when I go anywhere with somebody and they take out their wallet to buy something and start thumbing through the credit cards, you know the act I'm talking about.
Right, yeah.
What they're doing is, oh, this one's full. Okay, I can't use this
exactly,
one.
Exactly, yeah. I've been there.
you know the act. Well, I know I'm looking at a walking disaster. It just doesn't work. And while I'm at it, I'll say one other thing. This new thing that we're seeing, no pay for so long, you know, you buy your furniture, no payments for a year. You buy your this, no payments for 9 months, 18 months. You think this is a bargain? If you knew what that contract of sale was sold for to the person they call the factor, you'd say, oh, my gosh, you mean that store got 38 cents on the dollar because it gave me those terms? I could buy that same item for 38 cents today on every dollar it cost. And the answer is, of course you could. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, there are two store, other issues about this.
The store sells you $1,000 worth of furniture and tells you not to make a payment for a year. And you sign a contract, and you're happy as can be with all this furniture, which is, you know, as far as you're concerned, free until next May. The store takes that contract and sells it to a person who's called a factor. It sells it for so many cents on a dollar. The person's not going to pay $1,000 for that contract. They're going to pay far, far less because of the time, because of the uncertainty of your, you know, staying financially healthy for that long. So that store might get half a dollar for that, you know, $500 for that $1,000 contract. So what you're doing is you are paying much, much more, many times more, for what you think is a privilege of not having to pay for a while.
Aaron, I agree with you on that. There are two other issues around this that I have found. Number one, in terms of at least having that one credit card, is it's also helping that young person establish credit, so when they go to buy a house or go to sign a lease or go to buy a car, there's a track record that could be in their favor if they stayed on top of it. So that would be a third reason to have that credit card. But the other thing is, it's those contracts that are 12 months same as cash. So in other words, if you pay off the whole thing and they give you a payment plan, actually I bought carpeting for a house once and I had 3 years to pay it, and if I paid it within the 3 years, then I wouldn't be paying any interest at all. But what they did by setting up the monthly payments, and they don't tell you this, is that that last monthly payment is actually the month after the deadline. And once, I got furious, and luckily I caught it because I was really paying attention to these things. So I made 3 payments the month before the end of the contract, and they didn't get it. And they count on the fact that most people are not going to notice that. And what happens after those 3 years, you now owe them maybe another $1,000 or more because they put on the interest for the entire 3 years worth of that installment loan.
And most people, you're saying, wouldn't notice it.
Exactly. Oh. And they don't. They write it so small, they don't want you to notice it, of course.
Well, of course, what you're saying fits into a lot of the things that I talk about in this book, which is you're not dealing with friends. You know, unfortunately, these people, and that's a kind of a broad generalization, they are not on your side.
Mm-hmm.
Look at the profits companies make today that deal in volume with consumers, whether they be banks or insurance companies or Walmarts or anything else. I think it's rather obvious. You know, they have designed every engagement in a way that is profitable to them, and they have fleets of lawyers. I mean, trust me on this, I've represented all of these people many times over the years. You know, when something goes wrong with a consumer, a customer, a tenant, a borrower, person on the small end of the spectrum, and the big guy comes into the office, let me tell you what he doesn't say. He doesn't say, Jim, James, I want to be fair to this lady. She's got a good point here. She really does. What do you think I ought to do? I'm waiting. I've been in practice 35 years. I'm waiting to hear that. One day I will, I hope. But I haven't heard it yet. I have heard every single time, how do I get rid of this lady? What's the quickest way I can get rid? Do I have to answer this lady at all? Can I throw this in the garbage? What do I need to do? That's what I've heard. And the materials that I have indicated here are the things that they cannot throw in the garbage. In other words, I've used what I learned on one side of the table on the other side, and I'm not apologetic for it.
Mm-hmm. Actually, I'm going to be sending a copy of this book to my nephew, who's in his freshman year at Arizona State University in Phoenix. And my brother, his father, is actually a financial planner, investment counselor, stockbroker, all that stuff. And I'm actually curious, when my nephew Max looks at this, to see how much of this stuff he already knows that my brother taught him, or whether this is really new information for him.
Well, don't make your brother angry by suggesting he didn't teach him enough. You know, it's funny.
We'll find out. Now, yeah. we only have about 3 minutes left, and if there's a closing thought you want to leave my listeners with, how can they get in touch with you if they want to, or what's the most important point that you think this book makes that you really want to get across?
Well, first of all, they are perfectly welcome to get in touch with me, and the email address is Grahamon, my name, and Graham, GRAHAM.com, which is website at our law firm, and I answer correspondents with me. So I'm very happy to do that. The last point I want to make is a very general point, and that is for everyone who's getting ready to go out and face these things, don't be dismal about it. You know, you're not going to become, unless you're unusual, you're not going to become of the financial strength and size of all of these people and parties and corporations and companies you deal with on the other end. But you're going to be able to deal with them. And you're going to be able to deal with them satisfactorily with a very reasonable amount of knowledge and an understanding of certain terms and a few things Don't go into this thinking, you know, I got to get in the ring with Muhammad Ali and God help me, you know, mm-hmm. all I can do is cover my face and pray. That's not the situation. That absolutely isn't. You have some power. You have the ability to say, I'm not yet ready to make this deal. I don't understand. Mm-hmm. I want to buy this house. I want to buy these goods. I want to do this insurance arrangement, but I have questions.
Okay. James, I need to stop you there because we're out of time. And if you want to reach James or myself, you can also go to tellthetruthfaster.com and you'll be able to get information on him and the show, and the show will be archived within the week. We've been speaking with James Crayman, who wrote What They Don't Teach You in College, A Graduate's Guide to Life on Your Own. I want to thank you for being with me tonight, James. And I want to thank all my listeners, and I'll be back next week. This is Stuart Altshuler, and Tell the Truth Faster on KXAM 1310 AM in Phoenix, Arizona. Have a great weekend.
Stuart, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
That I heard of once.